Very good.
Good. Hi, Dave.
I see Phil Gladstone is there. Hello, Phil.
Yeah, hi, Phil. How are you? You're muted.
Yeah, actually, one thing is I much prefer Philip to Phil.
Oh, Philip, yes. Hi, Philip.
This is my virtual background because my room is too cluttered to.
That one looks nice.
Yeah. I must confess, I use real estate listings because they've always tidied their rooms. They have nice lighting.
Well, you know, there was a saying several years ago, many decades ago, QST held the messy shack photo contest, and one of the submissions was I couldn't submit the photo because the camera I took the picture with, I set it down on the shack and I couldn't find it again.
That sounds like me.
Hi, guys.
I have to say hi. I have to say hi to Kong, or Kung. He's one of our students here at the University of Scranton, and he is taking the digital design class, and he's been working with FPGAs. So I told him about this group, so he joined us this evening.
Oh, good. Glad to have him.
Hi, everyone.
Yeah. Hello.
Welcome. If you stick around for a few minutes, you'll probably be assigned a project to work on.
I think that's the idea.
I thought so.
That was the goal. I've actually already recruited him to give a poster at the Hamstai workshop called like Introduction to FPGAs, because I figured there might be some people who attend the workshop who don't know anything about FPGAs. Not in this list, I guess, but but there might be somebody, you never know. Anyway, I guess I better start recording and turn it over to Dave.
Before you start recording, I want to share this cartoon here in the upper right. This is the poster boy for Ham Radio Shacks.
I love that one.
So I know a guy that has that posted on his the outside shack. That's when his wife comes down and says, "You've got to clean this place up." And he says, "See that?"
Well, then now that you've put it out there, of course, you have to mail it to the distribution list.
Oh, well, I can mail you the link. I mean, I could put it in the chat if you want.
Please.
Oh, come on. That's not the right way. How do I get the... I tell you what.
You want to share your screen? Is that what you're trying to do?
No, I'm trying to get the URL for this picture here.
Oh, okay.
And it's not cooperating with me. I guess I'm just too stupid to use a computer.
I guess we probably ought to get net control to start the net here tonight.
Okay, here you go. This should work now, it says here. There you go. It's kind of a short URL.
Nathaniel, can we do the start the recording in a minute?
All right, go ahead.
Okay. Well, let's start the meeting. This is the Tangerine SDR and HamSci Personal Space Weather Station technical talk for February 23rd, 2021. And my name is Dave, KV0S. And this week, I've been working a little bit on a programming emulator. So I made some progress over my impediment that has gotten my way for the last couple weeks. It's one of those things that you work on and work on, and finally you fix it, and it seems really simple once you figured it out. So. Anyway, that's me. Other than that, let's see. I've been working on just doing some whisper beaconing and still have magnetometers running steadily collecting data. So that's it. Next on the list is Nathaniel W2NAF. Go ahead, Nathaniel.
Thank you very much, Dave. It's been a busy week here. I've been working with Bill Engelke on a little project. So it's coming along. And I've also been getting the HAMSI workshop in order. The committee met on Friday. We went through abstracts and we have a draft agenda set. So it's not finalized yet, but it's looking pretty good. So I'll probably give more information on that later. W2NAF, back to net.
Fine business. And next on the list is Bill, AB4EJ. Go ahead, Bill.
Well, good evening, Dave, and good evening to the net. Played around a little bit this week with the grape image, and now I have the ability to make the system, make everything, data collection and everything, start automatically upon boot up with a little bit of delay so that the network, well, configurable delay, so that if you want to run NTP, it takes so many seconds to synchronize the clock. And I figured out how to make an image of that and was able to upload it. So the image in raw form is something like about 50 gigabytes, but when you compress it with GZIP, you can get it down to about 5.5 gigabytes, which allows it to be uploaded to Box. So Case Western Reserve was able to retrieve that. So we have the ability to get that transferred to them. Also, I played a little bit further with the being able to store and reveal, or rather store and analyze data using digital RF. I found out that it is possible to store on the grape. We're running the chip, the sound chip, at 8 kilosamples per second. And I found out by talking to John that I was concerned about there might be some artifacts, but then I found out that John has a roll-off filter in his grape radio, which starts rolling off about 1.6 kilohertz. So what's interesting about this, it means I don't have to worry about filtering the 8 kilohertz sample because there's nothing much higher than a couple, 3 kilohertz in the sample. But the downside of it is if you've filtered out that much, you can't listen to the thing for the voice announcements because they're all higher in frequency than that. So it means with the grape, you can't really listen to them. I mean, I was able to set up the audio sync on GNU radio and plug in a set of headphones and hear the central tone, and it's there, but you don't hear the voice announcements. So, but anyway, I was able to store these in digital RF and was able to bring them back and then play them in a very, very narrow bandwidth, so we can see the Doppler shift very cleanly and very nice. And it's captured very nicely in the digital RF in a single channel. At first I was kind of confused about that, but Nathaniel gave me some pointers. Tom McDermott had given me some pointers about this, and I was able to prove myself experimentally that it seems to work. It's sometimes a little bit blocky or pixelated or something, but that's probably a tweak that we can take a look at. All of that is going to be applicable going down the road to the Tangerine data. That's one of the reasons why I'm playing with that. So, okay, back to net.
Well, fine business. I will let people know I seem to be dropping out every so often. So if I disappear, that's the problem. I'll try to get back. Next on the list is Dev. Go ahead, Dev.
Good evening, everyone. So we have started a new week, and today I taught my first class for this semester. And I think it went okay. It was a good experience for me to teach after a long while. So I think we're starting on a positive note. other than that, I don't have made good progress with the research, so I need to catch up. Thank you.
Fine business, Dev. And next on the list, we have Jim K4BSE. Go ahead, Jim.
I was concerned after last week's meeting where we're trying to pull out WWV down in South, at the South Pole, and concerned about other stations and the same frequencies. So I started constructing a spreadsheet with all the standard stations I can find that are on 5, 10, or 15 megahertz. I'm getting some others along the way too. And the bottom line is there are several of them. There are about three 10 megahertz stations in South America on, on 10 megahertz, I just said that, redundant. A handful in other parts of the world too. I sent a early version of that spreadsheet to Christina this afternoon. I tried to post it to the Reflector and it wouldn't go. I assume the Reflector just doesn't like attachments. I don't know how to get that distributed without sending it as an attachment. I think there is some cause for concern there. Are we really going to be able to hear WWV over the other stations reliably? That's about it.
Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, Nathaniel, you want to take over for Dave? It looks like he's frozen.
Oh, okay. So, sure, I can do that. Thank you very much for doing that, Jim. I appreciate it. And we'll have to talk with Christina about that. It looks
Nathaniel
like
looks frozen, too.
I'm frozen. But not. Oh, but in a different way, right? Yeah. And I guess it's good to know I didn't realize about that filter that was on the group either. So that's good to know. Okay. So next on the list, let's go to Greg, VA3CBN.
Thanks, Nathaniel. I got a few things on the go, but they're not related to your group. But I joined the Long Island CW Club last week. And I'm also taking an advanced course for my amateur radio, so I'm involved with that. I have a question for you guys or Nathaniel or whoever wants to answer. You always talk about, or most of the time, magnetometer. Can someone explain it to me in layman's terms, what a magnetometer is?
All right. Thank you very much, Greg. I will, in that case, call up Hyoman next, who can answer your question. Go ahead, Hyoman.
So you have a question about magnetometer in general?
Yeah, to someone that doesn't know about, like in layman's terms.
Okay, so I mean, simply speaking, it's an instrument that measures magnetic field. In this context, we are interested in variation of magnetic field in low frequency, which is about, you know, hertz range magnetic field. So we are employing a very inexpensive magnetometer, which costs about, I guess, $20 or so, so that we can measure the context level of magnetic field variation of the Earth to understand how the solar activity affects the geomagnetic field around the Earth. So that is the main purpose of this project. So I mean, magnetometer in general can vary in terms of performance level and in terms of like price range, like going from like dollars to, you know, $1 million. We're talking about really, really low cost magnetometer, which is not great in terms of scientific investigation overall, but for a general sense, we can have closely spaced array of magnetometers so that we can see the full context of space weather, you know, in a more global scale. Although we have to compromise the performance level. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, thank you very much.
Yeah.
Okay, Hyomin, do you have any other comments?
Do I have any comments?
Yeah, to say hello to...
Oh, is it my turn?
Yeah, it's your turn.
Okay, so well, since, yeah. Yeah, good evening, everyone. So nothing, I mean, it's been pretty busy week for me, but there has been no really big progress from the Hamsai perspective, other than some discussion going on with other scientists in preparation for the total eclipse that's coming up this winter. So one of my colleagues is actually talking about, he's actually running a meeting actually tomorrow where I think Nathaniel is going to be joining too, right? I guess, to talk about how a solar eclipse will affect ionospheric dynamics so that a number of scientists will get together tomorrow to discuss, you know, our scientific objectives, as well as some kind of campaign utilizing many instrumentation that we have down there, including SuperDARN, HF transmitter and receiver, magnetometers and stuff like that. So of course, what Nathaniel is doing right now is going to be highly relevant to this context. So otherwise, things are going along, and back to Ned.
Thank you very much, Hyomin. Dave Witten, KD0G.
Hello. I've been working on some stuff with WXPython, wrapping Hyomin's script to analyze the logs into a small visual app. I don't know, am I coming through? I don't seem to be appearing.
Yeah, you sound fine.
Okay.
Hey, you look good too.
Okay, I don't even see myself. So, anyway, I've been playing. I got tired of fooling with C and decided to play with black boxes again. So I've been using WXPython, kind of the other end of the scale. Other than that, not much of interest to anyone, I don't suppose. That's it.
Thank you very much, Dave. Let's go to the other David McGaw, N1HAC.
Hello, everyone. For the question on what is a magnetometer, the simplest answer is it's a compass. We're using three-axis magnetometers, but it really is just a fancy way of measuring the Earth's magnetic field like you would with a compass. I'm busy right now. We've got a sounding rocket that's getting hot, ready to launch in May. The VLF propagation experiment flying from Wallops, Virginia. So that's kind of taking my time at the moment. So back to Net.
Thank you very much.
Where is it going to be launched from?
From Wallops Island, Virginia, out on the Eastern Shore.
Yep.
And let's see, thank you. And next, James Wolford, KG4DSG. Hey, nothing heard.
Mike's muted.
I don't know, that mute doesn't want to. You got me now. You got audio?
Yes. Go ahead.
Okay. I don't know why that button doesn't want to work, but it doesn't. Just listening in, trying to tear apart a dead tower that apparently ate a CPU. trying to resurrect what I can. With that, back to the net.
Thank you. Dave, do you want to keep going?
Okay. I'm back and right now it's working. So have you done Kong yet?
No, you should welcome Kong.
Oh, hello, welcome, Kong.
Yeah, I should introduce myself. I guess my name is Kung Nguyen. I'm from Vietnam, and currently I'm a student at the University of Scranton, you know, with Dr. Fizel here. So I'm a student majoring in computer engineering and computer science. So that's why I have, so far I have a little bit of knowledge about FPGA. So I was just talking to my engineering professor, and Dr. Fizel just happened to walk in and listening on a conversation, and just a coincidence that I'm here today. So currently I'm not working on any research, but I did work on a little bit with quantum chaos last semester with another professor. So I'm looking for more interesting projects to join.
Well, I think Nathaniel has a number of interesting projects for you to get involved in. So welcome, and glad to see you here. And please come. We meet every Monday night.
I will be here. Thank you.
Very good.
Maybe we can find something to help have him help with the FPGA stuff.
Yeah. Scotty can use some help. Anyway, next on the list. Have we had Dan yet? N4XWE?
Okay, thank you, Dave, and hello, everyone. Can you hear me okay?
Yes.
All right, perfect. Well, got a little problem with GNU Radio and scripts, and it really had nothing to do with scripts, but had everything to do with GNU Radio, and I think Dave just froze up again. So I kind of put it aside for a few days, and I'm going to go back at it. The issue I have is GNU Radio compiles without a problem, but the gr-grnet is still giving me issues. I've become quite an expert with Git here as of late, and I know that I'm downloading the correct source code for gr-grnet, but it refuses to find the makefile, and I don't know quite why. I don't know if it's some little issue that I'm not doing correctly, although I think I'm doing everything correctly, or if it's an issue with gr-grnet. So anyway, I'm kind of stuck on that, but I'll get that sorted out. So back to you, Nathaniel. I guess you're back in control of things.
I did come back.
Whoops, okay. Sorry about that, Dave.
It's kind of confusing tonight with it coming and going.
Yes.
So let's see. Dave and Dave McGaw talked, I thought. So has Jay talked yet? WB?
Hi, guys.
Okay.
Just seeing here as usual, just greatly enjoying it and learning all I can. Nathaniel, just to give you a heads up, just before the meeting today, I fired off a couple emails to you at your convenience. And I'm interested in still, if it's possible to obtain a sensor package for use, you know, to deploy a sensor package at my house here in the northern suburbs of Detroit. So that's one of the things I wanted to talk to Nathaniel about, or anybody else for that matter. So other than that, nothing really new here. Thanks, everybody. Take care.
Fine business.
Stay safe.
And next on the list, see, it'd be Jonathan Rizzo, KC3EEY. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Hi, everybody. I haven't really been able to do much. I started my new engineering job today. It's quite exciting. I also want to mention, if anyone has not seen the video released by JPL about the Perseverance landing, the live video, it's absolutely amazing. And I would invite everybody to watch it. Maybe this could be for a general discussion, but Scotty, I was wondering if you got any farther on the Raspberry Pi and the beef module canal. Other than that, I don't have anything else. Back to the net.
Well, fine business. And then next on the list, we have Michael, AA8K. Go ahead, Michael. Well, fine business. And next on the list is Philip, N1DQ. I got it right, Philip.
Yeah, so this is kind of my first time here. My interest sort of arises. I run PSK Reporter, which has a kind of large database now of spots, which may be useful. The other thing that's sort of unrelated, but sort of related, is I actually just got my first Meteor camera up and running. I'm in process of putting up my second one. There is a network of Meteor cameras, which you can build out of fairly inexpensively, that watch the night sky and report meteors centrally, where if two people catch the same meteor at the same time, then you can actually compute its orbit. So, interesting stuff. Back to the net.
Very good. Hopefully I didn't get lost. It looks like I did.
Dave, are you there?
Dave's frozen again.
Frozen again.
I lost, all right.
The awful cold in
this. All right. How about Veronica?
Hello, everyone. It's nice to see you all again. So over the break, Dr. Bristow was kind enough to let me borrow an IC7300, and that was very fun to get that set up. I now have an antenna set up at my house on my roof. And I was able to listen to a lot of different stations, which was very fun because my first like actual experience with the real radio. Aside from that, I have a Grape set up at my house now and it's actively collecting data. And I had an altercation with my computer. So currently I can't really work on it, but I have been working on looking at the difference in time from when signals are received at my house with the Grape and Dr. Purcell's house with the Grape. And then also I am actively enrolled in Dr. Purcell's space physics class, which I'm learning a lot about the ionosphere and radio wave propagation and things of the sort. So that's all. Back to net.
Thank you very much, Veronica. That's excellent. Let's go over to Spotty, WATFI.
Okay, I guess audio's where, there we go. Trying to get a new background up, but I wasn't fast enough. Anyway, big, good week this week. One thing I wanted to let people know is that the West Central Florida Tech Con is coming up this weekend. And I know Tom and I are speaking there on Saturday. So I'll be talking about the Tangerine and Tom will be talking about GNU Radio. He can fill you in more on what he's going to talk about. And let's see what else. I sent off a magnetometer, another magnetometer board set to Jules. He wants to, I don't know what he's doing out there. He's making these giant arrays of magnetometers, I think, because every time I talk to him, he wants another one to hook up to the same pair of wires, and so he can read like 3 magnetometers off of one wire. So it's very interesting. He's getting it working too. So I sent that off to him. In fact, he probably has it by now. Let's see, Jonathan, I do have the pinout defined. I looked at all your documents, and we can accommodate all of the I.O. that you need. So I'm going to get you off an email momentarily and show you what I've gotten and let you make sure that I didn't mess anything up. And I also got an email from John McGibbons.
McGibbons?
Yeah, N8OBJ. Yeah. And yes. He gave me the pinout of the finalized pinout of the Grape Mark II. And we have all the IO hooked up to that. So we're going to be compatible with the Grape. So that's good news. And the other good news is I actually finished the schematic for the data engine. And the CAD guy now is off working on the remaining models, CAD models. There's still a lot to do, but I told him that there may be some interconnect changes when I do the FPGA project, but there's pretty much not going to be any changes in components other than a few caps and resistors maybe. And also our parts procurement person is Nona, who was just in here a minute ago. She's working on costing it right now. So we'll probably in the next day or two, we'll have a BOM cost anyway for what the data engine is going to cost. And so that's some serious progress. A lot of long days this week spent on that, but so I've basically gone through and checked every component that was on the board to make sure I had the pinout correctly. And by the way, I found 2 errors. So it's good to check these things 2 or 3 times. And let's see what else. I want to talk to Nathaniel a little bit about some posters. We have an opportunity to get some science posters, some space science posters up before the Ham Expo in March. That's a week before HamSci. So this might be a really good opportunity to recruit some attendees to HamSci because it's the week before or two. It's the 13th and 14th. So is that 1 week
okay.
before? So
yes.
Yeah. So that's another virtual conference that, and supposedly I think 20,000 people attend this. It's a big, big, big conference.
Oh man.
They had one in October and they were just
going to be busy.
Yeah. So anyway, so back to Ned. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Scotty. That sounds excellent. Let's go over to Tom Yarish. Tom, are you there?
I'm here. I'm working on another computer and I don't have much to say. Just wanted to check in with the group this evening and trying to get another machine up on Zoom and having my problems cut out for me here. So nothing to report. I'm working with the Hamcats group and Rob is pursuing his Whisper Demon adventures and nothing else comes to mind much, but we're all waiting for Tangerine to make its debut.
Thank you very much. Very good.
Thank you.
And next we have Tom, N5EG.
Oh, good evening, everyone. Yeah, I'm glad to see a good group. Not too much, just a few little conference calls on the clock and some other things. Not too much other activity this week. Back to the net.
Thank you very much, Tom. And Joe, W7 Lima Uniform X-ray. Joe there, W7LUX.
He's still showing his mic muted, even though there's no...
He's trying. His mic is blinking.
On the participants level, it still shows his mic is muted. So I thought, oh, they're switching around. So, okay.
Yeah. I think I got everyone then. Is there anyone else besides Joe that we didn't get? No. Well, in that case, why don't we open it up for general discussion?
About Tom McDermott.
We got Tom.
We hit Tom.
Yeah. Oh my God.
He was not last today. He was penultimate.
Hey Tom, next time you change your login name to AAA Tom, and then you'll be first up.
Yeah, I can be Quad A. I can be IPv6.
So, Scotty, very legitimately, are there any FPGA tasks students might be able to do or participate in? Are you at a testing level or?
Well, first thing to do would be to download the Altera toolset, the latest one, 20.1, the free version, and get that installed in your system. They have a Linux version and a Windows version. Pick the one that you're operating with, and get that up and running first. That would be the task.
Yeah.
And then when you get that up
and running.
Pardon me?
Kong, do you have that already?
No, I only have the Cortis program. We're using Cortis instead of.
So which version of Cortis are you using?
I'm using the latest version.
The which one?
The latest one.
Oh, okay. And you got that all up and running on your machine, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So as soon as I get the base system made, I can send that to you. And if you want to take a look at what we're trying to do is build a self-test, because whoever we send the boards out to, the production boards out to, or even the beta boards out to, they're going to have to do a test of the boards, because I don't want any boards back that don't work. And especially if we use an offshore manufacturer, you just can't be shipping batches of boards with bad boards in them. So we need to build a tester that we can send to the manufacturer to, and best is a pass-fail tester. We have lots of LEDs on the board. So I think it's typically we do loopback connections and just verify that, because we're not trying to verify any functionality of any parts. We're verifying solder joints. Shorts and opens is all we really need to verify, because we don't need to test the parts, because the parts are going to be most likely, they're going to be good. But the most highly likely thing that's not going to be good is we're going to get solder opens or solder bridges. So that's what we got to test for. And we have to test all the paths, whether we use them or not at the beginning. Yeah, because they will be used eventually, so we got to make sure that they're all good on the board. So that's if you got any experience in that, or if you want to get some, that would be something that would be useful, I think.
Okay, sounds good.
So sounds like if that sounds like something that you want to get involved in.
Oh yeah, I would love to.
Kung, do you want to tell Scotty a little bit about what you're doing in class with Dr. Berger? Because Kung was walking around with an Altera development board today.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Which board did you get?
I got the DE10 light right here.
Oh, okay.
I don't know if you can see it. Yeah, so I'm still in the beginning of learning about this board right here. And same thing with Verilog. I'm still pretty new with Verilog, but I had pretty long experience with programming, so I don't think that should be a big problem for me. And it seems pretty interesting. I didn't know much with the board yet. Let me actually.
Yeah, the hardest part with if you have a software background is understanding that everything works in parallel, not serially. And once you get your head around that, then it becomes much easier. So, and of course, obviously, the programming, you'll pick that up really fast if you've done other languages. But to understand that things are not serial, they're parallel, that's really important. And also to understand the synchronicity of everything. Make sure this crossing clock boundaries is what always gets people in FPGAs. So once you understand that, then those are two basic best concepts to get under your belt. And if you understand those, you'd be much better off. And I want to give a little example of, we were actually doing a project for a company that used a Cyclone 5 it was an optical scanner. And they were having a problem that the thing would crash every 10 minutes to 2 hours, but they couldn't predict when it was going to crash. It was just unstable. Okay. And sometimes it would run for hours. Other times it would crash right away after you boot the thing up. And they hired us to come in there and try and figure out what's going on. And they had like 20 or 30 files, Verilog files, that were consisted of the whole project. So what it turns out, it took me 2 weeks to find this bug. Okay. Now that's a long time for, I mean, they were expecting a fix right away. Right. And I said, look, you got 25 files. You don't get this in a day. Turns out what I had to do is I had to write down all of the destinations of, they had like 4 clock domains in the part. And you have to write down all the destinations of each of the 4 clock domains. And then whenever a signal crossed the clock domain, that's where you have to look. Okay. Turns out I found that they had 2 10 megahertz, they had a 10 and 100 clock domain, and they had used the 100 by mistake instead of a 10. I took one ASCII zero out of the entire source code, and the thing worked. But it took 2 weeks to find it. So I referred them to the you all have seen the Steinmetz cartoon, right? Where this was a guy that came in to consult for GE because they had this generator that was making a noise and they couldn't figure out what was the problem was. And so they hired this genius Steinmetz to come in, and he says, okay, I want a cot and I want a pad and I want the door locked and no one in here. And I don't know how many days it took him, but he comes in, finally lets them back in. And there is an X marked on the outer surface of the thing. He says, it's under there. And they said, okay, that's great. You know, and they start taking it apart and they found the problem, and they said, how much will that be? And he says, $10,000. And they go, $10,000 just to put an X on the generator? We want to see an itemized bill for this. So he gives them an itemized bill. He says, placing an X on the generator, $10. Knowing where to place the X, $9,990. So it's all in knowing where to place the X or where to take the signal and change it with another one to make it work. But
yeah.
So anyway, that's my classic clock boundary problem that you're going to see. If you work at FPGAs at all, you'll see it eventually. And especially if you work with old time hardware guys, you're going to see a guy that's going to take a D flip flop and connect the clock and the D through an inverter, thinking that he's going to get a delay so that he gets the setup time for the flop. But then the compiler takes his gate out and he doesn't get any setup time, and he just can't understand why it always goes metastable. Don't understand why it doesn't work right. So anyway.
That in a similar sense happened to me, a real life situation where the compiler messed me up at a work situation where we were trying to figure out why the watchdog wasn't working. And, you know, we were going through the manuals and blah, 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 blah. And it turned out it wasn't our code. It was the compiler. It was the optimizer.
It helps you.
Screwing us up. So when we turned off the optimizer for that section of code, everything worked fine.
So you got what you asked for without the optimizer. And
yeah. And it was only a few lines of code. It had to be assembly language. The nature of what we were doing, it had to be assembly language. So, but the compiler, because we were writing to the same address, we were setting flags at one address, you know, bit 0, bit 5, bit 10, whatever. It just said, oh, hey, you've got 3 sequential instructions. They're all writing to the same physical address. I'll just combine them all in one write statement. And the hardware didn't like that. So that's that really happened.
Yeah.
Where you know, the compiler, the optimizer screws you up.
Well, there's a very simple example of that, where if you're building a flip-flop out of basic logic in a CPLD or whatever, there's a redundant gate in there that makes sure that it flips properly, and a compiler will take that out if you're not careful.
And it'll help you to make a mistake. Yeah, so really the important thing is, I know Altera and Xilinx both have their campaigns to claim that you don't need to know anything to program FPGAs, and they all have software packages that try to help you and make it simpler and simpler, but there's no substitute for knowing what the logic inside the FPGA is. And I mean, you don't have to know down to in like the old days of flipping bits on and off. And but you really, if you know the architecture, it helps you understand what thing, why things don't work. Because I've seen so many times people get so at a, such a high level, they paste all these blocks together, these IP blocks together, and they have the compiler helps them by connecting buses, point-to-point buses, by putting multiplexers in. So they, I think the AXI bus is like that. It's a point-to-point bus, but you want to hook three things on it. So it puts a multiplexer in there for you. Well, that's great as long as it works. But if it doesn't work, you don't know what to do, because it's all been done for you. And now you don't have any visibility into what actually happened. So it's really good to do some debugging. And with Altera, you've got the SignalTap. Have you ever used SignalTap before?
No, not yet.
Okay, well, it's invaluable. So that's another thing, to build a simple circuit and then fire up SignalTap. And what it is this logic analyzer that goes in an unused area of the FPGA that allows you to connect up to existing signals and display them graphically, like just like a hardware logic analyzer, and it runs over JTAG. So if you have the Byte Blaster on there, then the Cortis tool, well, it's subsidiary program that the SignalTap graphical user interface will allow you to look at things and probe things, and it's amazingly useful. You can find information out that you'd never be able to find out any other way without running extensive simulations. So it's a cool tool, and it's built into Cortis.
So, Scotty, can I jump in here with a similar question? So in the data engine that we're building, and how are we going to trigger the bootloader code in your design versus HPSDR, which had a hardware jumper?
In other words, to make it come up into the bootloader mode?
Right.
Well, what we can do in the Max is, since we have two images,
right,
and we have an image that will contain the bootloader that's separate from our runtime image, what we'll do is we can have the command over the Ethernet say, go to the other image.
We can
actually command it to go to whichever image we want.
Okay. What I need to know is what kind of command from external, not from Cortis, but from an external signal can cause that command to flip.
If you want to cause it to boot a particular way, you can hook up to the configuration select jumper. But if you're running one thing, like say you're running the code, the real code, and you want to reprogram it. So they call it RSU, remote system upgrade. So what we could do is we could put a hardware pin on the part that you pull down. Like, for instance, we've actually done this with a TXD line from a serial port. So say you have an external something that has a serial port that communicates with the FPGA. Normally that port would be not used, right? It would sit idle. So the TXD line would sit high. And then what you do is, as soon as you see a transition on the TXD line, you say, oh, go to the bootloader, and you switch over.
So you do have that available in your design for the data engine, right?
It's available on any design if you
can. I just wanted to make sure we don't start building them before we have that.
Well, like I said, this last one I worked on where they added the remote system upgrade capability later, it was kind of like there all along as a requirement, but they never really got down to actually implementing it. And they built a whole bunch of boards.
Okay.
And then come to find out that the configuration select pin was left floating on all their boards.
Yes.
And so I thought, well, no problem. We'll just turn that off, because I have the option to not in user mode to not use the config select pin. Okay. Yes. But what they don't tell you, that you have to go dig down deep in the documentation, is in programming mode, in initialization mode, it's always active.
Yes.
So you can't just say, oh, I'm going to let it float and then expect to get a particular image.
Right.
So what they have to do, and this is really hokey, but what they have to do is they had to boot up, and then since they don't know which image they're going to get, because the pin's floating. You might get one or the other. If they go, if they come up into boot mode, they have a way to look and see if certain things have been initialized. And if they haven't, they say, oh, we're in there wrong, and they switch to the other mode.
Yes. Okay.
So they actually load one and then exit that and load the other one. So it takes twice as long in the boot mode, but booting up is only microseconds anyway.
Yes. I
mean, hundreds of microseconds, but so are a couple of milliseconds. So it really is not even noticeable, but it's just a hokey way to do things instead of going where you want to go.
Well, I've been going through, well, building a simulator, but that also makes me think about each of the steps that we have to go through to put images in and confirm them. And I'm thinking about the differences between our current board and all the HPSDR boards.
Well, this is
good. Have a hardware switch, as you know. It's, well, it's basically a jumper.
I have seven jumpers on the board that can be used for anything you want, although they don't go into any kind of hardware. I mean, there's just something you can read.
Okay.
So you can read it and say, oh, you want to bootload. Okay. And then switch.
I think it'd probably be better the first option where you you pull something, a signal line.
What would you think we'd be using externally to do that?
I don't know.
Just like a computer serial.
Well, essentially, I have to get the hardware in a situation to receive the bytes.
Okay.
And then I start stuffing packets at it.
But you're going to do that via Ethernet, right?
Right.
So, yeah, so basically you just got to be able to switch to bootloader mode via Ethernet.
Right.
And how do you do the way you do it in HPSDR is you just load an area of the ROM that is not used.
So
how do you switch it then?
It's divided into, the whole ROM is divided in half.
Right.
And the base address is zero. And the other address is 1,000,000. So if the jumper is on, it starts at zero. Are you still there?
Yeah, I'm here.
And if the jumper's off, it automatically starts at 1,000,000 and runs from above that.
But the question is, how does it do that? Because that's not an automatic feature of the part.
No, it's in the FPGA code.
So, but the FPGA code, let's see, because I think this is on Hermes, the FPGA code always boots to a particular address.
Yes.
And then you can read the data, you can read the jumper, and then you can reboot to a new address if you want.
Right.
So that's how it works, right?
So basically, when you turn it on, you either have to have the jumper on or off. And when it boots up, that tells it which part of the memory to look in. And you can't switch live.
Right.
You have to reboot. Physically turn it off and then switch it and then turn it on again.
But that's what that implies is that you always boot into a particular area of the ROM.
Right.
And then that code has logic in it that looks at the jumper and says, should I stay here or should I go to the other one?
No, it actually uses the jumper to decide.
Well, yeah, but it's got to use some logic to decide, and it can't have any logic until it's booted. So, because there's no external logic.
So there is, there would be logic in there to say, well, if it's off, I'm starting up at 1,000,000, address 1,000,000.
That logic would be in the bootloader code?
No.
Because if you have the bootloader code, then you probably can't talk to your Ethernet software.
You can't talk. Well, you can talk to the Ethernet, but you can't talk to any of the RF parts.
Well, you can't program the board
right
by Ethernet, right? Okay. Because I know
send all the data by Ethernet.
Right.
This is all to avoid having to use QRTIS for everybody.
Right, but is that code in the release code or is that in the separate boot area?
It's in the boot area.
Right, so if you don't have the bootloader, if you erase it for some reason.
If you erase it, you have to go back to QRTIS and put a new bootloader back in.
But you can still run the radio. You just can't go and...
You can actually program the radio in zero and it works, but you just can't upgrade it.
Yeah. And because there's actually an output pin on the FPGA that causes a reconfiguration to happen.
Right.
And that's the thing that they did on the Cyclone part. Cyclone.
Support. It was a Cyclone. Well, Metis is 3, Hermes is 4, and everything else is 4. All the other Apache boards are all Cyclone 4.
Yeah, and that's why the Max is a little bit different than the Cyclone 4s or 5.
Right, right.
Because they don't—they have the internal ROM, and then they have these they have a hardware state machine, so that if the image A is corrupted, it'll automatically flip over and load the other image. So at
some point, we need to sit down and describe, write down exactly how this is going to work.
Yep. Yes.
I'm trying to write.
Pretty soon, actually.
Yes, I'm trying to write steps from my side in the code of what I'm doing, and I'm trying to pay attention to where I need to ask you specific things that have to happen in the FPGA.
Because what would be good is to be able to load a block of data, like 256 bytes,
right,
and then ACK that.
Yes.
Rather than put a checksum across the block, yes, and then ACK each one. Because my philosophy is that the only thing that doesn't get ACKed is the stream of data.
Right.
Every command, every programming command, they all have to be ACKed by us. Not right. A TCP/IP triple back and forth, but just an ACK back. And even
yes.
So that if you set one and it got an ACK, then you could send it again.
And that's the way Hermes or the protocol 2 does acknowledge every packet.
Okay, but it doesn't have a checksum, right?
But originally, protocol 1 did not acknowledge packets. You just sent them, and if at the end, if it didn't work, it didn't work.
But on protocol 2, is each packet protected with a checksum?
No, but it's acknowledged.
But you're acknowledging what?
In protocol 2, there is not a checksum. It's a sum. They just sum the packet.
Okay.
So it's a poor check on errors.
Okay, but there is some kind of error checking. So if yes. It didn't work, then you'd have some.
It's a very simplistic version. Okay. But I've been spending a lot of time reading CRC 32. There is a variation of CRC 32 in GNU Radio. So, I mean, there's a lot of reasons why we should use that.
Yeah, and CRC 32 is just a bunch of XORs, right?
It's basically a polynomial equation that you run over the binary data, and the remainder is what you send.
Right.
And there's a polynomial, a base polynomial that you declare, and there's like 3 or 4 common ones, or you can make your own, but it's probably better to use a common one.
But again, this is just, I mean, from a hardware standpoint, this is just taking the incoming data and XORing selected bits into the sum or the checksum,
right,
and then accumulating that, and then
right. Inside the hardware, you run the same thing. And I sent you a CRC 32 Verilog code in an email.
Okay. Yeah, I haven't had a chance to look at it. But yeah, I think if it's just XORs, it's trivially easy to run fast.
Yes. Okay. So I just wanted to give you, I know you like to have an example to start from.
It makes it much easier, yes.
Yes.
Hey, one of the things that I think is going to be a little bit different about our FPGA loads here is in OpenHPSDR, we basically had one load per module. There may yes. be there were updates that would come along with that load, but they were all from the same basic tree. And I think in this project, we may get to the point where we're going to have different loads, because we're going to be doing different things. Do you have any placeholders or way in the data set so that you know which kind of load, plus also the revision that is existing on the DE?
Well, the discovery packet should give some of that. We've got a version number, a protocol, and protocol doesn't really mean anything to us, other than what we make it mean.
Okay.
But we need to have in the code, the Verilog code itself, an embedded revision, an embedded type, and the things that you can read to say, oh, I'm a VNA. Oh, I'm a VLF receiver. Oh, I'm a PSWS, right?
Well,
that, Tom, right?
Right. And we may do some dedicated signal processing in the FPGA
for
applications, but not one there for other applications.
Right.
Right. And so I see this becoming a tree with a lot of branches.
Yes, I don't see a problem with that. I see the big problem. So when you do a discovery packet, it should reply what's loaded in the FPGA at this time. And then if you want to load something else, you just go through a reprogram.
And you know, I can see how we might have standard supported versions, and then we'd have part of the field would say custom. And then the custom would have extension bytes that you could then pick for your own and say, okay, I'm going to be custom hardware 37. And if you get popular enough, enough people will want that load that they'll be able to go and select that.
Yeah. So right now, Discovery will report back the revision number in the Discovery response packet.
Yes.
But it doesn't say anything about what kind of load it is.
No, but we, like you said, we have a lot of bits. There's a whole bunch of padding zeros that we could use.
All right. It's just something to put on the to-do list, I guess.
Well, I've been working on a document. I'm going to share it with you, Tom.
Okay.
Of what I'm doing. And that's just, I'm going back through stuff. I haven't worked on this since early 2000s. So it's like refreshing my memory of how it all worked.
But so really, Tom, it's like querying the board to see what capabilities the RF boards have.
Yes.
I mean, it's a similar thing. It's not the same thing, but it's like, I want to query the capabilities of this board. And part of that capability is what's loaded in the FPGA, right? So theoretically, we should have a lot of slots available.
So we have kind of a two-dimensional configuration here. We have what boards are plugged into which connectors. And then we have the what software or firmware or FPGA code is loaded into the data engine, because even with identical hardware capabilities, we could have quite widely different.
Yep. Right. And it makes sense for all the different kinds of design ideas we have that we need something much more flexible.
Okay.
You know, there are a pair of bicolor LEDs next to each RF module, and they will, so you'll be able to, the FPGA code will be able to read the ID of each module and say, do I know what that module is? Or do I not know what that module is? Do I know how to talk to it? If I don't, red light. And then that means the user has to go do something. Or green light says, I got everything plugged together and I understand that board and I can talk to it.
Right.
And I don't really think, I didn't do that for the leaf or for the clock module, although they do have ROMs on them. Because the leaf has a ROM because it's a Raspberry Pi ROM. And the clock module, we're going to put an ID ROM on it just the same as we have on the RF modules. So you'd be able to tell what kind of clock module it is that you got plugged in.
Okay. Yeah, good. I just wanted to make sure we took care of both of those.
Yeah,
sounds like you're on it.
The easy part is to connect the ROMs up. The hard part is to decide what to put in them to identify what everything is and to document it.
So,
go ahead.
All I was going to say is right now I'm focusing not on the actual code to make the radio work, but the code to program.
Uh-huh.
So that's where I'm putting my effort for the next couple months.
Okay.
And Tom, did you see the document I sent out to you and John on the clock module for the pinout definition?
I looked at it briefly. I don't understand the clock well enough to make a good comment.
Well, what I want to do is I'd like to have a table like that for the RF modules and for the data for the leaf module and incorporate that into the ICDs of those boards.
Okay. So the ICDs for the receivers have all the pins defined.
Right, but I want to put that table in there that describes which ones can be programmed, which ones should be fixed, and what levels they are, and more of a description of each pin.
Okay, that,
Can we do that?
I'll look at it. I thought all of that was already in the receiver. It already gives you the direction, whether it's bidirectional or single ended, the voltage, all of that's in the receiver ICD.
But the bidirectional pins can be programmed to be monodirectional if you want them, unidirectional.
Okay, I'll try to look at the document and see what additional information I can figure out from it and add that to the receiver. And
it seems like it's going to be very complex to describe what all these pins can do, because since the FPGA can program them either direction, open collector, LVDS, whatever, we have to be able to tell the users, well, which pins are those? Which pins are paired together? Which pins are not programmable as I/O? Well, they're all programmable as I/O, but there are some restrictions on, like on the I2C, where we say the ones reading the ID they're like separate dedicated pins. So you can't reprogram those because the FPGA needs those to go read the ID ROM to figure out what the board does. So to figure out which way to set its pins, if you will, because I'm envisioning that the pinout table could be in the ROM. So we could, when the FPGA goes and reads the ROM, it could set the IO pins. It can't set the voltage level, but it can set the direction and the type.
Okay, well, yeah, I'll look at that clock module document and see if I can figure out what you're looking for. If I can't, I'll just send you a simple email that just says help.
Okay. And I can send you that document's done in Word, right?
Yes. I think most of them are done in Word.
So if I could send you the paragraphs describing the pins, if that would be helpful for you to incorporate, if you could tell me what would be good.
Okay. I'll look at it and noodle for a while, and I can send you the Word documents for whatever you need.
Probably most important for the Leaf and I don't know who else is going to be designing boards. Already we have Jonathan's going to be doing the Leaf board. So it's important for me to get a document like that to him, which is what I need to work on next. So, because the interface is very flexible, but it does have its limitations. Like IO voltages, when you have to move all the IO voltages and the bidirectional pins all at once. You can't have some 1.8 and some 3.3. So maybe a limitation.
Well, you answered what I needed to know, although I'll have to spend more time asking questions. I think the three of us will have some. And I'm sure John will get in. Oh, by the way, I saw your talk with John, and it was good.
Oh, okay. At Hamcation, when we did Hamcation? Yeah, it was kind of like a turbo talk. That was like, I think I had 23 slides, and I had 10 minutes. So.
Yeah, that sounds familiar, Scotty.
Did it sound too rushed, or was it okay?
And I did have fun trying to get my head around Michelle's talk. So,
yeah,
it made sense, but I have to think about it some more.
I especially like the yo-yo rolling up,
or the fishing reel.
The fishing reel was brilliant.
So the reel is basically your phase.
Yeah,
and that's a clever way to explain it.
It is.
So, now whether people really understand it, I don't know, but
I think you have to explain it all different ways, and sooner or later one's going to go click, and then you get it.
It makes a lot more sense when you already know what she's talking about.
Yeah, okay, I guess that's true. Yeah. Too many late nights, I think.
Yeah.
I was actually watching a video by Milton Friedman. You know who that is?
Yes.
And they were talking about when they would take their retreat up to the country, up to New England, and they said there was no electricity, so they would read by kerosene lamp. And they were both night people, so they would stay up till 3-4 in the morning, and then they sleep till noon, and then they get up and and I'm going like, that sounds really familiar. Because, you know, you just, there's more to be done, so you just keep working. I mean,
yeah. Well, and it's quiet at night.
It's quiet.
Yeah.
Even the cat goes to sleep.
Yes. So, I don't know.
If I could just interject something. One thing I hate about all these boards is this use of bicolor LEDs, because I'm red-green colorblind. And when people say, well, what color is the LED? I go, I don't know, it's red, green, something like that. So a difference that if it's flashing, I can tell, you can tell flashing and solid, or you know, that stuff, but a red or a green is impossible for
what, okay, is so it? What we could do for you is we could make good the green on and bad flashing alternately. You could detect that, right? Because they're physically separated from each other by a slight amount.
I could probably tell that. But well,
if I was trying to turn it off in between, then you could see it would be green off, red off, green okay. off. So you could see it would look flashing to you, right? So that yes. you could tell anyway. Well, I know we had a color chart for the grape. John sent me a chart with color-coded pinouts, and I go, first of all, I'm not colorblind, but I don't do really well with shades of color that are close together. So, you know, like light purple and dark purple, I don't. And he had like 8 different colors, and you try to pick 8 different ones that you could distinguish. So I put a column in there with the pin numbers, so that you don't really have to see any colors at all. You can just look at the pin numbers and figure it out. So, yeah, well, that's a good comment for us to make sure we put that in the code to do that. It's just that these LEDs, they're 0603 packages, and they got 2 LEDs in them. How can you resist not using a part like that? I mean, they, no, it's an 0603 part, right? That's like 60,000s by 30,000s, and it's got 4 pins on it. The 4 corners are the 2 different LEDs. It's like, wow. Okay. And the green ones alone, they're 0402s, so they're fun already. But to have a bicolor like that, how could you not use it? And my CAD guy was lecturing me today about using those small BGA voltage regulator chips. He says, you know, you use some of those parts you use, you're going to restrict who can build this board for you. So, well taken. But we're going to use the biggest parts we can use that fit on the board. And if we need space, we're just going to go to the smaller parts, because I don't want to make the board bigger. Mm-hmm. I think that's, but on the other hand, I don't want to raise the cost of the assembly either. So, and actually I'm not really that concerned about the cost, as I am concerned about places that just won't be able to do it. They'll say they can, but then they'll build the board and they'll get, you know, 50% yield because they can't, the technology is beyond them. So, you know, SOICs are really easy. You can actually see the legs on them. So, but they're still too small for me to put wires on. So I have a question for Nathaniel, if your question's answered.
Yeah, I think mine's done.
Do we have any posters that we can export to like a PDF version of that are to talk about space weather science type focus rather than engineering? Because I don't have, all my stuff's in radio engineering. All I have is the presentations you've made with some slides, but it's not really a poster.
Let's see.
The posters aren't always
restricted. Well, we have
that software that you were using, are they?
What's that?
So, like for the, so when you build a poster using that software for the conference that you just had, what was it, a couple weeks ago? Are you able
at
to
AGU? Take,
yeah. What's did
yeah that doesn't. That doesn't export well to a PDF. Like it, you can print it to like almost a paper. So you can get a paper out of it, but you don't get like a nice poster PDF like I think you're looking for.
Yeah, and I think that's what I am trying to think of.
Yeah. I don't know that we have a nice one. We have the one that Christina did for AGU like 2 years ago, but I think that's still more of an engineering poster than a space weather.
Well, it would be okay. I mean, engineering is okay, but I think the focus I'm looking for is more the space weather science aspect. You know, what is space weather?
Yeah.
Why do we want to measure it? What effect does it have on us? That kind of thing.
It's like a very generic overview poster.
Yeah, because I was asked if we have a tangerine poster, and I had to admit that we don't. So, not yet.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Yeah, I don't have one. I don't know that I need it by like the 13th.
Yeah, I need one by the 1st of March.
By the 1st of March?
This is a different show. This is, it's the
Ham Expo. Anyone, an actual paper one?
No. I want a PDF one. And I've got someone to help me work on the PDF who has Adobe, the full end Adobe, who can do embed videos and PDFs and things like that. But I've got to get content, and I don't have any. I could provide content for the tangerine, but for the science one, not so much. So even if I look at and copy, you know, that would work.
Mm-hmm. Tornado. Yeah, I'm trying to think if there's anyone who could kind of do this. I am like so booked myself right now that
I don't want to impact your scheduling.
I know where you can get comic books, space weather comic books. I'm serious. There's a whole series of space
weather comic books. Christina did would be good.
Yeah, I mean, I can send you that. I also have the one I did of the solar eclipse QSO party, and. If you're looking for content, I mean, I can send you the links of the ones from AGU that were virtual, and then you can, you know, work with that content.
Can I get download the images from somewhere? Do you have the images that you use to make those, or whoever?
It depends. You'd have to contact the author of the poster. So for mine, I do. But like for Christina's or Diego's, you email them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, because that's kind of what I'm looking for. And I know it's kind of short notice, but I think the...
Work with... I have the... I've given lots of talks. Why don't you pull stuff out of my talks?
I could do that. I could pull the images out of there. Because a lot of those images are in your talks. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I just gave that talk at Propagation Summit. That's got lots of great stuff in it.
I just thought maybe you had some posters pre-made, but if they were made using the special software, they're not really going to be able to be exported, right? They're for that event that the software was licensed for, right?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the way you export it. You basically print it out into a PDF. I can show you.
But then, like embedded videos are gone when you do that, right?
That's right, yeah.
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 And actually, I'm not sure. Embedded videos, the kind of embedded video I want will be like the video of the Doppler shift for WWV. You know, like a 30-second clip condensed, a 24-hour condensed into 30 seconds, showing how it's kind of like an animation. Because the embedded...
Yeah, you should email...
Yeah.
Email Christina.
Okay.
She has that video. She'll be able to give that to you.
Because embedded videos, to me, should be maybe 15 to 30 seconds long. And then if you got a longer one, like a presentation, you should just put a link to it on the poster.
Right. Yeah. Here, this is. I will share this talk with you.
Because we actually have an opportunity to share a booth at Ham Expo and put something up there. We don't have a booth, but we're being offered space. So I don't want to turn that down if I can help it.
No, yeah.
So no talks. The talks are all booked, but the posters are up in the booths. Virtual
posters are good.
Yeah.
Yeah, I just sent you a Google Drive link with the talk. It says for the Embry-Riddle Space Science Group, it's basically the same talk I gave for the Propagation Summit.
Okay. So it's a PowerPoint, or what is it?
Yeah, it's a PowerPoint. A couple embedded movies in it.
Well, I got one that there's no way I'm going to open that.
You have to download it.
It's from tmomail.net. That's not you, right?
Yep. No, mine should be coming from Google Drive with Virginia Tech. It should be from frizzell@vt.edu via Google Drive.
Okay, this is a link to a YouTube video about gravity and time with four attachments that I will definitely not open. Because
yeah, no, that would not be the one.
Looks not like it's from anybody that I know.
Right here, I can also just send it directly to you in the chat here. There.
Okay.
Do I have audio now?
Yes.
Yes, you do.
Okay, thanks, W7LUX.
Did you want to make a comment since you didn't get on in the main session? If you want to make any comments, Joe, feel free.
Oh, I'm brand new with this and just wanted to see what was going on and offer help if any of my past experience would be that. I've got pretty fair amount of experience in precision timing and frequency.
Okay, good. Well, we're going to have a fancy timing board that's going to need tweaking. So it's beyond my pay grade too, that all the timing stuff. Do you know John Ackerman?
I do not.
He's a member of the Time Nuts group, and I always joke with him because he's got like two rubidium standards in his basement, and I told him, you know, a ham with one clock knows what time it is, but a ham with two clocks is never quite sure.
So I probably have three.
Oh,
not really. I only have one rubidium, but I've got a pretty darn good.
I think your audio cut out there.
1, 2, 3. Okay. I have one rubidium, but it's a very small one, but I've got a good, GPS, DO.
Oh, okay.
Both of you are in Arizona.
I am Flagstaff, Northern Arizona.
You're in Safford?
Say again.
Where did you say you were?
I'm in Flagstaff.
Okay. I'm in Tempe. So.
Oh, okay.
That's about 130 miles away, Nathaniel.
Ah.
So you must be getting some good weather up there, Joe.
It's been okay. We had some wind, but we did get some snow, and it took a while to dig out from somewhere between 30 and 40 inches of snow, but nothing like what happened to my brother in Austin, Texas.
Oh, yeah. Mm.
Well, so Scotty, I'm starting to fade a little bit here.
Okay, I got the download. I think So Embry-Riddle, are there more branches of Embry-Riddle than the one here in Arizona?
There's one down in Florida.
Okay.
That's the one I spoke to.
Okay.
Yeah, it's in Daytona.
My friend Kshitija is the professor there.
Okay, I'm just... just saving it here now, so... Okay, 183 megabytes, not bad.
There's a lot of little moves in there.
And there's lots of pictures, or let's see.
Lots of pictures, little movies. There's some audio.
Oh, I hate this. I put it on the computer. Oh, there it is. I was going to say, I lost the directory that I made. I hate it when that happens. You know, back when you had only 5 minute hard drives, you didn't have this problem.
I know.
Okay. Well,
back in the day when everything was on core memory.
Yes. Yeah, we had the computer that I learned on had 16K of core memory, 16K words. Wow. So it was 16-bit words.
Wow.
It was a germanium transistor-based mini computer.
Whoa.
And everybody else ran the simulator, and I liked to use real hardware, so I would run the real computer.
Who was the manufacturer of that computer, Scotty?
It was called a Data 620, and I think it was just called Data Corporation. It was built in 1968, I think, and it was like a 19-inch rack, 7 feet tall, and 2 feet deep. Heavily modified by the students in the EE department, and I still remember my professor was railing. He hated CMOS logic. And this is right about the time CMOS was starting to get fast enough to be actually considered as a real viable alternative. Well, he had a student who used a 1-of-4 decoder, CMOS decoder, to select the memory banks. The delay through the decoder was 1,000 nanoseconds. It was an entire microsecond. And even for core memory, that was pretty slow. So... he was railing against CMOS, and I just remember all the stuff I'm doing in my home lab, right, is all CMOS, and he's saying, oh, that CMOS stuff is no good, it's too slow, oh, that's terrible, and I just had to go, keep my mouth shut, because this was the guy that I told you, I don't know if I told you this, but first day of class, right, student raises his hand, he asked the question, and the professor, I kid you not, the professor says, well, that's a really stupid question. No more questions the rest of the semester from anyone. After he did that, he just shut everybody off. And I think he did it on purpose. So he wouldn't have to deal with questions. So he was a cranky old... You could tell he knew his stuff, but he was not really a good professor, in my opinion, because he didn't really... He looked like he'd rather be somewhere else. So it's too bad.
Didn't have the heart of a teacher.
Didn't have the heart of a teacher, but we gave him a hard time though. So he deserved.
Are we about done here?
Yeah, we're done.
Nathaniel needs to be excused. He's about to fall off his chair.
Yeah. Hit your head on the keyboard.
Does it look that bad?
I can tell you're falling asleep. So let's go QRT. We'll get together next night.
We're way over anyway. But it was a great session.
Thank you, everyone.
Stay warm back there, everyone.
We'll try. You too, Scotty. Bye, Veronica Kung.
Bye.
Bye.
Everyone. Bye-bye, everyone. Jonathan, Bill, Mike, Yeoman.
You want to lead this on, Nathaniel?
Yeah, you're going to become the host.
Oh, boy.
Have fun.